The Athletic.
The Athletic Women's Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Now. With a Now Sports membership, you can watch the biggest moments from the Women's Super League live. Find out more at nowtv.com.
They've had their warning, they've had their warning. Here's Lucy Bronze!
That is remarkable from Arsenal.
Kirby with the ball up to
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Women's Football Podcast in partnership with Now. Coming up, Super Sub Mead shines at Wembley. Exclusive interviews with black icons of the game Hope Powell, Kerry Davis and Anita Asante. And will the Seagulls be gunned down and who'll win the Battle of the Blues? We look ahead to Sunday's FA Cup semi-finals. Well, joining myself, Kate Borsey, it's former lioness and football legend Kelly Smith. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you very much. And making her debut, BBC football journalist Emma Sanders. Howdy, Emma.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Good to be involved.
Very nice to get you both on. I know both of you were at Wembley at the weekend for the game against Northern Ireland. A super, super game. Well, I think for both sides, we can take positives from both sides, can't we? But just a couple of quick words. We will go in detail later, but a couple of quick words from you, Kelly, on what it was like to be there.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. I was lucky enough to be asked by the FA to go up in a box and watch it, and just to see the crowd fill up as time got closer to the game, to see the Lionesses walk out, Leah Williamson, captain the side. I have very fond memories of playing with Leah at Arsenal, so it was a very proud moment for her and her family to do that in a competitive game. And it just was such a surreal moment because for so many years, you know, I played the game and it just became the latter part of my career that the FA Cup finals just started to happen on a regular occurrence, I think from 2015. And now it seems with the Lionesses, this could be a regular thing, having home games at Wembley, the home of football. So I just hope that we can continue to get more people into the crowds and generate a bigger fan base and get more support for the Lionesses.
Yeah, Emma, you were across the BBC live text feeds. You were writing a report, of course, a match report of the game as well. And I'd imagine that you were in something of a frenzy from about the 64th minute onwards.
Yeah, it's always a fun occasion at Wembley for one, but especially when the goals start flowing towards the end, part of you wants them to continue, obviously, from a kind of football fan perspective. But when you're trying to write a report, it's always one of those where you turn around and you're saying to the person next to you, like, oh, I really hope another one doesn't go in the last 5 minutes.
Well, Kelly, we thought last weekend could have been the moment when your goal scoring record for the Lionesses was broken by Ellen White. But in actual fact, it was a different England player who stole the show.
England corner. And Mead. That is special. Super work again from Lauren Hebb. What a second half she's having. And there's a beautiful cross and an even better finish. Superb technique. It's Beth Mead again. England away. Is this four? Well, it might just be. It's hat-trick time. Beth Mead with three goals in 14 minutes. An incredible night for her here at Wembley.
Beth Mead! Hey! Beth Mead, everybody! Beth Mead!
You can tell Ian Wright enjoyed Beth Mead's performance there, couldn't you? It was the stuff of dreams for Mead, though. She'd only been on the pitch 23 seconds when she scored from an acrobatic shot on the turn. And 14 minutes later, the sub had a hat-trick at Wembley. The first ever Lioness to do that in England's first ever competitive game at Wembley. The other Beth, Chelsea's Beth England, scored a tap-in to make it 4-0 to the Lionesses against Northern Ireland. That means that England women maintain their unbeaten run in the World Cup qualifiers. I saw a reply to a tweet afterwards and I've forgotten who sent it, so apologies, but I love the fact that someone wrote, "Save the Beths till last." I thought that was a genius comment. Let's talk about Beth Mead and her bouncing back, I suppose, after that disappointment from not making the Olympic squad to now September Player of the Month, and then this wonderful hat-trick at Wembley for her, Kelly. I saw a bit of an interview where she just said she'd sort of decided not to care so much, if that doesn't sound so negative. I guess not to worry so much about what people think of her and just to go out and do her thing.
Yeah, I think that's nailed it spot on. I think you can control only what you can control. And for Arsenal, she has been in outstanding form. It's like she's a new player, a new signing for Arsenal. It's really given her a real buzz and a new lift, the new manager coming, Jonas. And I actually messaged her after the third game and just said, what is he doing? How come you're playing so good? And she got back to me and she said, it's nothing that he's doing individually, but he just the way that he likes to press high and the energy, that's how she likes to play. And he's just given her a newfound energy and a confidence to do that. And it's, she feels like she's playing the best football under him now because she's enjoying it. And like you said, I think she's playing, from the start of the season, she's playing a little bit angry and trying to prove people wrong, that she should have gone to the Olympics. And this is just a knock-on effect of her getting her head down, being quiet, working, going away and getting her fitness levels up and then letting her feet do the talking. And boy, is she doing that right now.
I'll ask the expert on Beth Mead's first goal, Kelly. This one goes to you. How difficult was it for her to do what she did there? Do you think she intended to do it from the off, or that was just the kind of way it played out?
No, I think she knew what was happening, especially when you're an intelligent striker or winger that she is. She just found herself in the box. I think she was only just on it. It was her first touch. And just the way she knew where the goal was because her back was to goal. And she just turned and just... It was almost like a bicycle kick, but standing
yes,
with on
sort of sideways
one, leg,
one. Yeah.
Sideways kick. But do you know what the
flamingo
where she,
kick?
Where she put the ball was exactly where it should have gone because of the whole technique of it and just spinning around. You know, if it would have come a little bit to the left, the keeper would have had it. But it was just the audacity and the swivel in her hip and the strength in her leg just to angle it past the goalkeeper. It was just an outstanding strike. And to do that, you know, you haven't really got any touches on the ball yet. You've just come on the pitch. And the focus that she had to do that, you know, she's 100% focused. She's ready to help her team. And there's no better way to prove to the manager that you maybe should have started them scoring a goal like that.
Yeah, absolutely. When karate meets football, I think that one's best described as. Let's talk about other players who impressed as well. And we will move on to Northern Ireland as well, who were really, really resilient and actually contained the Lionesses so well for at least the first hour of the game. But in terms of the England side, we must talk about Lauren Hemp, of course, 2 assists, great supply from the left-hand side. Did she jump out to you as well, or is there anyone else here that needs a mention from you, Emma?
Yeah, Lauren Hemp certainly jumped out for me. She's someone who I've always admired. I remember kind of when I was studying at university, she was kind of breaking into the England youth teams, and actually she was one of the first kind of England players that I interviewed back in, I think it was 2017. I think she won the England Young Player of the Year. And I've kind of followed her very closely ever since. And what I absolutely love about her, and this is something that Sue Smith said to me in an interview a while back, was that she just plays with no fear.
Yes, and it's true.
And every single time she picks up the ball, she's looking to do something with it. So I think that gives the crowd some excitement. It gives her teammates kind of a bit of an idea of what she's looking to do, because they're always then immediately making those runs and trying to attack the box, because they just know that when Lauren Hemp is in possession, she's going to be looking to drive to the byline and put something in there that's going to give you a good chance of getting a goal. So I can imagine she's a dream to work with if you're a forward. I bet Kelly would have absolutely loved playing with someone like Lauren.
Oh, definitely, Emma. You know, she's one of the players that gets me off my seat at a game. There's so much talent in this young kid. When she gets the ball and she picks her head up, she's so quick over the initial, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds when she gets the ball, dribbling in and out. She can use both right and left foot, and just the way she uses her hips to manoeuvre. There's not too many people in the game that can beat players with ease like she does. And the quality of her deliveries too. I think that's probably why Ellen White has got so many goals for City and England, because of the understanding that they have of both club and country. But, you know, she's going to get better too. She's only in her early 20s and she's going to be an outstanding player for England for years to come.
What do you think of Serena Wiegmann's choice not to appoint a full-time captain yet, to spend some time thinking about it, Kelly?
Yeah, I totally understand it. You know, she hasn't had Lucy Bronze in the squad. She hasn't had Steph Horton because of their injuries. These are two big leaders on and off the pitch. And she wants to see how they are in camp, how they deal with certain situations, how they are on the training field, how different players react to what they say, and just gauge it that way. There is no rush, really, because, you know, on hindsight, they should qualify. They will qualify out of this World Cup group, and there's no rush to absolutely nail it on. She wants to pick the best captain for the team, and when those two players are back in, I think she's right to assess it then, and then give the armband to who she feels will help the team better.
Interesting. Emma, let's talk Northern Ireland. Some of those players, of course, are still semi-professional. And Kenny Shields talked about after the game how perhaps the athleticism, the fitness of England's players won out in the end. But as we've said, for a good hour or so, I thought they held England brilliantly. They managed to swallow up all of their space. You know, England's creative players just didn't have that room, did they, for the first 60 minutes or so?
Yeah, I thought Northern Ireland turned up to, you know, work hard, be resilient, be determined, be feisty, which is kind of what they've been known for throughout, certainly their qualification for the Euros, but obviously at the start of this World Cup qualifying campaign as well. So I think they could be really proud of what they achieved. You know, you spoke about what Kenny was saying in terms of the fitness, and I think there's still a lot of work to be done from the Northern Ireland setup in terms of their movement to full-time, which I know they're hoping to do in January in the new year, to just give them that bit of a better advantage really going into the Euros, knowing that they can compete with athletes on the same level, as well as obviously in terms of the technical ability from a footballing point of view. But you know, you look at the side and they were without some key players, Simone McGill obviously at Everton, and Rebecca Holloway, who we've seen in the WSL as well. They had, I think it was Kelsey Burrows and Rebecca McKenna, who I think are both 20 years old. They're certainly young. And they were playing out wide in a back five, essentially, coming up against Lauren Hemp, who was just constantly running at them. And then obviously Nikita Paris on the other side, and Beth Mead, obviously, when she came on as well. So they were given a real run for their money. But I think they can be proud of their performance. And I think that there's a lot for them to look at and build on. And, you know, Kenny spoke before the game about learning from these experiences against higher ranked sides. And I think England certainly would have given them lots of things to think about.
Goalkeeper Jackie Burns, Kelly, produced save after save, and she was wonderful.
She was outstanding, probably player of the match. You know, if not, it wasn't given to Beth Mead. But she really kept the scoreline down, and some of the saves that she were making, you could tell the England players were getting a little bit frustrated. They were resorting to long distance shots, and it was either coming off the bar or she was pulling off a brilliant save. But she was bold, she was brave, she was coming out. She was really a leader for them back there. And she's certainly a force to be reckoned with, and there's a great future for her.
There is an argument, Kelly, that England could have been more clinical in this game against Northern Ireland. 34 shots, 11 on target. Whether that was down to them and being clinical or just the heroics of Jackie Burns, I don't know. But if we take a step back, with your experience, you've seen several iterations of the England team over the last couple of decades. How excited are you about this team, and is there something still for us to consider, for us to think about the side needing to work on perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I'm extremely excited by seeing the mix that England have in terms of youth and experience, and the exciting young talent that they have, attacking talent certainly. I think when you play against a team that's ranked a lot lower than you, it's so difficult, because, I mean, people think it's easier because they're not as, so to speak, talented as you. But when they sit deep and they play five at the back, you have to really think a lot more about your game and move the ball a little bit quicker. Try not to take too many touches. Give it and go. So sometimes it's a lot harder to play these teams rather than it would be a Germany or a USA, because you're kind of on that same level. You could say that they could have been more clinical, but they had hit the post, the bar a couple of times. The keeper was outstanding. But I don't think that they would be frustrated at the fact that they didn't score 10 or 8 like they have in the previous games. They won the game, and that's all that matters. The only kind of small concern for me is that they haven't really been tested in this group. You know, if they play against France or Germany or Sweden, how are they going to defend and get numbers behind the ball and cut out the sloppy mistakes that I've seen in the past that have cost them? So it's okay scoring against 10 against Luxembourg or Latvia. It's how you defend and get numbers behind the ball and keep possession. And when it's close, what are your big players that are going to come up and step up and win the game for you?
All right, well, let's round off the England chat there. In the other World Cup qualifiers for the home nations, Scotland beat Hungary 2-1 with goals from Christy Grimshaw and Rachel Causey. Wales drew 1-1 with Slovenia. Kayleigh Green equalised before being sent off for a second yellow. Also worth a mention, Katie McCabe has been shining for the Republic of Ireland. They only lost 1-0 to the second best ranked team in the world, Sweden, after an own goal by Louise Quinn. Pretty unfortunate, but there's a great viral clip, by the way, of Katie McCabe nutmecking Sofia Jakobsen. If you haven't seen it, lovely listeners, you should definitely give that one a watch.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to the Athletic Women's Football Podcast, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
With the Lionesses playing their first competitive match at Wembley since it was rebuilt, it's a moment to look back on how far the women's game has come. For Black History Month, we wanted to shine a light on two black pioneers of the women's game, Kerry Davis, the first black woman to play for England, and current Brighton manager Hope Powell, who played alongside Kerry for England until 1998, before managing England for 15 years. Well, producer Sophie spoke to Kerry and Hope.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. We're so excited to have you both. Well, let's take it back to where it all started. Firstly, with you, Kerry. You know, you have this amazing achievement. You were the first black woman to play for England, scoring two goals in your debut in 1982. I wonder what was that like as a moment? And also, were you aware of the significance of that when you were playing?
Aware of the significance, I'm going to say... but as you get older, you think to yourself and you look around, even at work, you see that, you know, I'm the only person of dual heritage around. It impacts me more now when I just look around and there's still a lack of diversity in most places where you go. It was my ambition to play for England. That was the most important thing. You always want to play at the highest level and see how good you are and just score two goals. I was very happy with that, very happy.
Who did you play against, Kerry? Sorry, Sophie. Who did you play against?
Northern Ireland.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Hope, I was just wondering, seeing Kerry do that, did that kind of inspire you? Was she blazing a trail for you or...?
I didn't actually see her do it. So in all honesty, no. The only time I recognised that Kerry played for England was when I actually got in the squad. So I didn't know her beforehand. And back then, the accessibility of watching England isn't as it is today. It was completely different. You wouldn't even know that England were playing, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough, I think when I got into the England squad, there was Kerry, and then I also came into the squad with Brenda Sempari. So at that time, correct me if I'm right, Kerry, there was three of us.
Yeah.
I was the youngest, so at least I had a couple of players to look up to, which probably made it a bit easier for me back then.
And Kerry, you obviously got the goal-scoring record for the Lionesses and you kept it till 2010, which is absolutely amazing. I'm just wondering how it felt to get that record and then also to see it hold for quite so long.
Well, to be honest, I knew I'd scored those amount of goals. My friends and family knew, but it was not recognised by the FA, not at all. It's only... I would say the last couple of years that it's come up. I did an interview with Sky and it was mentioned there. Then I think just recently the FA have acknowledged that I was the top goal scorer. It was always other people. So, yeah, I'm very proud of it. The fact that we didn't play as many games back in the day made a big difference. So my ratio of goals per game, I'm very proud of.
That's brilliant. And I'm getting this sense from both of you, both in terms of the record of goal scorers, but also Hope, when you said you hadn't, you know, seen Kerry play and it's not on TV and things like that, that the history and what had happened before, it's just not out there necessarily for people to see. And Hope, I was wondering if that is something that you would potentially like to see more of, kind of more of these recognition of these past achievements and just so everyone can know what's happened and have this documented.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and I think it's perhaps a big piece of work that is missing. I think without former players, without former coaches, the game wouldn't be where it is today, and we can't take that for granted. I think, you know, and Kerry's absolutely right, those previous records that were laid for some reason pale into significance. I think we have to respect the fact that the game hasn't just materialise the success and rise of the England team, the success and rise of the domestic programme hasn't just materialised. I think a path was laid way before me and Kerry got involved, way before, you know, the likes of Lily Parr, who we'll talk about, that era and the era before that. I think it's so important to recognise and appreciate the work that's been done by others to pave the way, and those players that you know, elevated the sport, and you know, those players that, you know, like Carey, top goal scorer, it should hold some recognition, so that I think young players today recognise they need to understand where the game was before, you know, they come into a fantastic building like we've got, and you know, you're training on grass pitches, you've got your own gym. It was not always like that. So I think some, you know, a lot of work needs to be done to highlight, you know, the talent of the past that got us to where we are today.
And Kerry, I'm just wondering, what are you most proud of in your career?
Probably with England, we got to the European Championship final. We lost on penalties to Sweden, but the fact that
a penalty, Kerry.
Pardon?
I think the penalty I missed. If I remember.
So I think something like that, I think the way we did it, Hope knows and Hope understands, because the environment that she is coaching in now and managing in, and what we had to do, we had to pay to play football, playing for England, we had to use our own money, our own expenses. I've known us get to Ireland after train on the car park. In Italy, we had to train on the beach because the coach didn't turn up. And we did things the hard way, but still got to a European final. You'd got the Germans, the Swedish, the Norwegians in that competition, and we got to the final. And also, I think probably one of the biggest regrets is how other teams progressed, or the nation, should I say, quicker than England. It was only when the FA took over, Hope started the ball rolling, that things moved forward. So, yeah, getting to that European final, was my greatest achievement and the most satisfying.
That's brilliant. And as you mentioned there, Hope got the ball rolling. Hope, you brought in, as everyone always mentions, you know, first Black England coach, first woman England coach, youngest England woman coach. And I was just wondering, I was struck by how many groups there you would be representing. Like, that must have been so much pressure. I know you've talked before about kind of thinking that you weren't expecting to get the role and you just felt like you had to take it. How did it feel like representing all those groups? And also, I wonder what advice you might give for someone else who might be put in that kind of position.
I think you have to, you know, and it's a well documented phrase, the pressure is a privilege and you just roll with it. And I think the most important thing is to be authentic and do the best you can do. I think the advantage I perhaps had was that I was an ex-player. I went through all those experiences that Kerry went through, and it gave me the mindset to kind of push it on and look at what others were doing and just make those progressive changes where I could. It was very much a challenge. Every day was a challenge. And the important thing for me was to, I never forgot, you know. I remembered what went before. I remembered the player, you know, where we had to pay to play, where we travelled on a Friday to play on a Sunday. We had one and a half day preparation for a major international fixture. I don't know if you remember, Kerry, we slept on a gym floor before. You know,
yes, we mentioned that the other day.
Yeah, gym floor. No, but I forgot about the bus in Italy not turning up. Training on the beach, training on, I mean, it's just night and day. And I don't think anyone coming into the role or a role of that magnitude should really, you know, appreciate what went before, because I think that then gives you a little bit of determination to keep pushing it forward and making it better. For everybody, not just players, but for staff, for, you know, everybody involved within a club side, a national side. You know, what went before, we just want to keep making it better. And I think on top of that, players being appreciative and humble as to what they've got now, so that the next generation can learn by their example. And I think that's really, really important. To me, it is anyway. Mm.
And you built so much, Hope. In reading your book, it's just incredible how much of the structure you built and the teams that you built to kind of push women's football forward in England. And I think a lot of people will be very grateful for you for doing that. I wonder, having built all that and having such an amazing, you know, coaching career at 2009 Euro final and returning England to the World Cup in 2007 and managing the GB team in 2012, among all your coaching and your playing, there's probably a lot of moments to choose from, but I wonder what you're most proud of.
I think England qualifying for the 2007 World Cup, because we hadn't been in a World Cup for the previous three tournaments since 95. So that was a massive, massive moment for everybody involved. And a real opportunity to raise awareness and raise the platform. And then managing the GB side was a magnificent opportunity that actually I didn't want to do. So I'm forever thankful that I did do it, because it's probably the best experience as a coach that I've ever had in the game. Not just because of the game and GB, but everything around it. You know, the different sports, it's just incredible. So I think those are the two key moments for me at the moment. And then I'm hoping that with Brighton, there are many more great experiences to come.
Obviously, Hope, you built so much of the structure, and I know there's a lot of talk now about how we can get better Black representation in the England teams, in the coaches. Obviously, there's yourself, you're doing a fantastic job, but you know better than anyone else how to build a structure. So I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what you think could be built or changed in order to create a pathway, whether it be for Black coaches, Black support staff, Black players. Do you have any ideas on that?
I was quite involved with the diversity code and chairing a group of Black coaches that are in the game presently, and giving them an opportunity to work with some of the England youth teams, which has happened, not just Black but female as well. So that is ongoing, and that they've been invited along to England camps, and that seems to be pretty successful. I think what probably needs to change is the opportunity for those players on the pitch to then sort of transition into coaching. We seem to have lost quite a number of Black players coming through the game. If you look at the current England squad, I think one, Demi Stokes, at the end of the game, if you're looking at the game the other night, there were no Black players on the pitch. If you look at the youth teams, minimal Black players. And that's something to do with the pathway now to get into an England setup. You have to be part of the pathway. With the best will in the world, the FA, and I was part of that, wanted to professionalise the game, lower it down, get centres of excellence, as they were once called, aligned to the men's team, train at decent facilities. The challenge is that those facilities now are in leafy suburbia, which are hard to reach places. which quite often means if you're from a lower income background, which unfortunately a lot of the black kids are, to access the facility is quite difficult. You know, the bus ride is long if you haven't got a car. You know, you might need to get a train. They're very difficult to get to. So what the solution is, you've got to bring the football into the inner city so that the kids can access and you know, have a scout network that looks at those kids to bring them through. And then hopefully that translates into coaches translate into managers. That would be my solution.
Thank you so much, Kerry, Hope. It's been fantastic to hear you talk. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Kerry.
You too.
Well, that was producer Sophie speaking to Hope Powell and Kerry Davis. Kelly Smith, you'll be very aware of both of these pioneers of the game. What was it like playing with both Hope and Kerry?
I was a young kid coming into the fold, playing for Wembley Ladies, and Hope and Kerry were both regular starters and big characters within the squad. Certainly amazing, talented players. Hope was so good technically on the ball and so fast coming out of the dribble. And she kind of bossed the midfield when I was started to break into that England side. And Kerry was a striker, liked to drop back into the hole, very good at holding the ball up, spinning and turning into the space. And her goal scoring record for the amount of games that she played was phenomenal. I think it was 44 goals in 80-odd caps. So both of them really strong, good characters within the England team that like to have a little bit of fun and jokes along the way, but were really serious as soon as they stepped over that white line.
You broke Kerry's goal scoring record, of course, Kelly. I thought it was interesting how, you know, Kerry said that sort of really her record, which obviously stood for a fairly significant amount of time, wasn't really recognised by the FA up until recently. I thought that was something interesting to note. You were managed by Hope as well, Kelly. Tell us about that.
I had two managers in my career for England. It was Ted Copeland for a year or two, and then Hope took the reins and was the manager ever since. So she was learning on the job. She had to fight for a lot for us. I remember that we were playing in big oversized men's kits for a number of years. We were training on pitches that were really way below what we should be training on, really heavy, boggy pitches. The hotels that we were staying at were below par standard at times. And, you know, she wanted the best for us at every opportunity.
Was there an awareness for you as players that, you know, Hope was breaking down barriers as the first, you know, female manager of the England women's side, as the first black manager too? Was there any awareness of that, or was it just literally all about what happened in training, what happened on the pitch?
No, I think some of us were aware of it because, you know, she never had an office at Wembley. Eventually, when we were kind of based at Wembley, she had to fight for an office. They didn't want to give her one. But the men had an office space, the men's head coach, but the woman didn't. It just didn't make sense. And she wanted more equality within the game. And she was always fighting for better stuff for us, always, whether it be a bus or a better hotel or traveling times at decent times so we weren't flying through the night or flying home straight after a game. It was all about being as professional as you can and getting respect from the FA that probably didn't have it at that time.
Great example to set, for sure. Well, to find out how much it's changed for players since Hope and Kerry's playing days, and to highlight another outstanding black player, producer Sophie spoke to Anita Asante.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. We're really excited to have you.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Obviously, you have such an amazing career behind you. I was looking through, you know, 5 league titles with Arsenal, the quadruple in 2007, playing for Team GB, and also 71 caps for England. I was wondering, with so many achievements like that, which one of those are you most proud of?
I think most definitely the quadruple season with Arsenal, because, you know, I think it takes a lot to win all competitions and to have that belief as well as a group of players to maintain it for a season is, you know, I think was probably quite outstanding for the time, you know, considering we weren't full-time professionals as well. And I just think, you know, it would be something that's be so hard to replicate in my career anywhere else. And I think it just took a very special group of players at that time to create something historical.
I actually wondered when you were little, how aware you were of the role models who came before you. I'm thinking maybe specifically in terms of Black women. So we've just spoken to Hope Powell and Kerry Davis. You know, were you aware of those players and what they were doing? And were you looking up to them, or were you not so aware of the history?
In all honesty, I wasn't so aware of the history. And, you know, I think it was a shame that that was the case. And I've learned a lot growing up over the years and playing about these players. And I think the first person, African descent or, you know, of another ethnic background I came across was Rachel Yankee, who coached me at Arsenal, the Centre of Excellence, when I first got into the Centre of Excellence. And then later on, going to England and playing under Hope, did I get to learn the most about her career and what kind of player she was and all the sort of major achievements she had as a player, but also as a manager. And then much, much, much later down the road to learn about Kerry Davis, who I've been fortunate enough to meet now on several occasions, and is just an absolute legend, obviously. So, yeah, I think it's super important to understand, you know, what these pioneers have done for our game and where it began. And I'm happy that now, you know, I've had an opportunity over the years to learn more about them and maybe see footage as well. And obviously being fortunate enough to play with the likes of Rachel Yankee and Mary Phillip and against players like Eartha Pond definitely was encouraging for me. And, you know, they inspired me and mentored me in a way as a young player. So I'm very grateful for that experience. And I hope that other young players also get to have the opportunity.
I'm just wondering, obviously, your experience, you know, it's an intersectional experience. You know, you're a woman, you're a Black woman, you're a gay woman, and you've spoken about that before proudly. And I wonder how your experience of football, you think, has been shaped by that intersection of all different identities, you know, gender and sexuality and race all coming together.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I just think the most important thing is to be proud of who you are, proud of where you're from, proud of what you do, because there's enough different perceptions or opinions out there that tell women they can't do X, you know, tell Black women you're a certain type of woman, you know, all these sorts of things. So for me, I've never really looked at that, at, you know, myself that way growing up. I just was a young girl playing. I didn't think of myself as a young Black girl or XYZ. It was only till when you become conscious of the world around you, do you realize what those challenges or barriers might be? And then, you know, then you start to work against it. And I just think being a female footballer was an act of activism in itself, because there was, you know, it wasn't, there wasn't a professional game. There wasn't maybe all the clubs out there supporting the women's game. So any girls playing of that generation and before, they were already, you know, activists in a way. And then, you know, then to be try to be a visible role model, which I hope I'm able to do, is just to be present, to be here, to speak up, to show my talent, to allow other young people to see themselves in me, and that they can, you know, be here one day at the top level of the game and want to be here, you know, and want to be those ambitious young people that want to break records and all of those things. So, yeah, I think, you know, but the intersections also allow me to have a sense of community, because we say sport is about bringing people together and bringing people from communities together. Well, that was my experience growing up. And that's one reason I loved it. The area I grew up, I was surrounded by kids from all sorts of backgrounds, girls and boys. And it just made me feel part of something much greater than myself. And I got to learn so much more about others and their cultures as well.
That's brilliant. Obviously, you've played in the US and in Sweden as well. I'm just wondering what the experience like there was as a Black woman. Were there a lot of other Black players playing with you? Was it a kind of inclusive environment? How was it different to the UK?
Yeah, I think when I played in the US, that was the first time I got to play professionally, actually, full time. And there wasn't a great deal of Black players on my team, actually. And I think it was much later in my third season when Eniola also, we played on the same team, that I had another black player on my team. And before then, when I was at St. Louis, I played with one other African-American player. So there's still quite a minority in terms of representation, I think, across the US league as well. And, you know, that's something that they probably will have to consider when they think about their pathways and why that's happening. But, you know, I think also when you're in a professional world, you're kind of in your own, you're in a bubble with other sports people, and you don't always think about those greater problems, if you like. So it didn't really affect me in a way that I thought, oh, this is not allowing me to be the best footballer I can be. I always got the opportunity to be part of a team and play and all of those things. So for me, it was largely a positive experience. But I agree in terms of, you know, in terms of talking about inclusion and those things, they weren't really things that were discussed, I would say. It weren't really things that were sort of in the consciousness, perhaps, of everyone in and around players and staff and sort of the organization of the clubs. But in Sweden is probably the place that, yeah, wasn't hugely diverse on my clubs. But actually, in the last 2 years of playing, you know, I had a Cameroonian player, I had Marta, the Brazilian, and we also had a lot of other European players who spoke different languages. So in a way, it felt, you know, like meeting lots of people from lots of various cultures, and the idea of inclusion and how to make the space a safe space and connecting with the community was a big part of the organization of the club itself. In the projects they're involved in. They were involved in projects in South Africa. They were involved in social projects in Malmo in Sweden. And actually Malmo felt like a quite a diverse city. So I met lots of people from all over the world there. So I really did feel like a space where, wow, like, you know, I am seeing people who look like me. I can find the Afro hair shop down the road and get the products that I need, which, you know, it sounds so silly and trivial, but actually in real life terms, you can live in places where you can never find things that you need for your needs. And that was a struggle at times. But there, you know, I found one shop with an owner who came from Ghana as well. So there was also a shared background and we could discuss food and culture and all of these things. So, yeah, it was a really positive thing, but it also entered more my consciousness and my personal activism by playing at a Swedish club, which was all about progression and helping young people have opportunities, especially young girls.
And you're playing in England now. Obviously, looking around, there's been a lot of talk about how there's actually not that many black players in the England setup in the WSL. You know, we've got two black managers, but that's it. And obviously, lack of black people in the sports staff as well. I know that's quite an important issue. I'm just wondering, first of all, what it feels like being in that environment? Does it affect you?
Yeah, I think for me, I've gone through the game such a long time now, not having that everywhere, that I think you either adapt or you go bust, isn't it? It's like you go with it to meet your own ambitions, or you just won't. You won't participate. You will leave the game. You will do other things. I'm fortunate that, you know, especially the early years of playing, I felt like I had a lot of diverse people around me in terms of coaches and players and my general community. It's when you leave that and the further up you go that you start to see less and less and less of it. And I think for me at times, of course, it'd be nice to come across someone that maybe you could ask advice from, you know, in that environment, and who might understand you, not always based on race, could be based on gender as well, but based on your lived experiences, your backgrounds, you know, your social backgrounds and things like that. So, yeah, I think you want a game that is reflective of society, but you also want a game that's reflective of the area that they are based in sometimes. And I think that's also, you know, interesting. You know, I played at Arsenal, which is in Hackney, Islington, you know, probably one of the most diverse cities and all townships in London. And where you look at where the club is based in terms of training ground, it's miles away from the city. And I think then you do probably exclude a large number of young people that can't afford to make that trip. transportation or don't have the support that would allow them to play for a club like Arsenal. And I'm just using Arsenal as an example. There's a number of clubs structured in the same way. And I think that's where the real shame comes, because they are pillars of their communities, these clubs often. And young people and adults alike, their first entry to sport might just be, you know, they live up the road from the stadium and they hear that kind of fandom and the atmosphere, and or, you know, they follow the team and that's what brings them to the game, you know, that love of it. But yet they might not feel included and they can't participate. And I think that's a great shame. So, yeah, from my perspective, I've always said it'd be nice to have more diverse staff in around players, because players can learn a lot from other people, from various lived experiences, who can also provide different kinds of ideas, different kinds of solutions to problems, you know, and that we can lean on, because we all have also different styles of communicating and we have people that we connect with better than others at times. So I think that's why it's important, because there's some things you may not address. If, for example, I had an all-male staff, then I would if there was a female in the room or, you know, someone like that. So I think that's why it's important.
Just to finish off, I'm just wondering if, you know, you could in 10 years' time see one thing have changed in women's football for Black kids who are coming up into football, what would that be?
I think general equality throughout the structures of football, that we don't even have to have this conversation because it's just the norm. That would be, you know, what, like, amazing, because then everyone is just feeling part of something and connected to something that we're all in, you know, passionate about and that we all want to be part of and we all want to support ultimately. So I think if young, you know, Black kids in particular, but kids from all diverse backgrounds, South Asians, can look up and go, you know what, there's a coach here, there's a manager there, there's a boardroom person there, you know, whatever it is, in any environment, and feel like, yeah, I belong, then that would be fantastic.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Anita. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, no, my pleasure.
That was producer Sophie speaking to Aston Villa and former Lioness Anita Asante. Some really interesting points there, Emma, to pick up on representation, the pathway for Black players as well. I mean, we can reference what we've heard from Hope too on this, that actually, ironically, as the games become more accessible, better funded, and as the games got so much bigger in terms of exposure, it feels like the opportunities for young Black girls to play for the England side have got more limited. And we heard Hope's feelings and also Anita echoing it too, actually, about how hard it is for young Black players to access the regional talent centres. Just expand on that for me. It's not something that personally I'd actually put two and two together on yet, but it's a great point that they both make.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've actually had conversations with people sort of off record and just out and about whenever I'm kind of working on things within the game, and especially people at the FA. And I've kind of asked, you know, what the long-term plan is and what are the short-term plans in terms of trying to access these areas of, you know, more diverse backgrounds and trying to make sure that young players can actually get to these RTCs. And I think that is still a problem. And as you say, while the game grows from the top, certainly from a national team's level, but also as the WSL grows, then I think we're starting to see more clubs come together with their men's sides, which is obviously very good. But Anita brought up a good example of obviously Arsenal's training ground sort of being in an area which is just kind of not really near the city centre. It's not somewhere that's easily accessible. And, you know, we kind of joke among the media how difficult it is sometimes to get to training grounds or to women's grounds. So if we're kind of struggling just to gain access, just to either go and watch a game for one or to report on games, then certainly as a young player trying to get to training every single day and ones from, you know, diverse backgrounds or, you know, all kinds of different backgrounds. And I think it is something which needs to be addressed. And I think, you know, just getting those pathways sorted has to be an absolute priority for those involved in the game going forward.
Well, our thanks to Anita Asante, Hope Howell and Kerry Davis for speaking to us. You're listening to the Athletic Women's Football Podcast in partnership with Now. Joining myself, Kate Borsay, it's former Lioness Kelly Smith and BBC football journalist Emma Sanders. Bit of other news now. Arsenal and Scotland defender Jem Beattie has also been really vocal this week for Breast Cancer Awareness Month about encouraging women to get screened for breast cancer. She was diagnosed with the disease a year ago and had surgery to remove a lump in her breast. We on the podcast wanted to echo that message. Go and get checked, please, if you're listening. Kelly, I want to check in with you as well about the WSL Hall of Fame. I've not spoken to you since. You sit, of course, alongside Farrah Williams, Rachel Yankee, and Emma Hayes in this WSL Hall of Fame. It was brought about to mark 10 years since the inception of the WSL. A huge honour, I'm sure, for you to be there.
Oh, absolutely. I was stunned when I got the email asking me if I wanted to accept it and be one of the inductees. I was totally gobsmacked.
I always wonder at you, Kelly, because you are one of the best players of your generation, but you still need to be reminded of that.
Yeah, I think when you've stepped away from the game too, and you just work in, you know, do bits of media work and that, you kind of forget that you played a little bit. But yeah, just to see the panel, you know, the amount of reputable people, you know, former coaches, players, managers, journalists, to see that they know the game, they've worked in it over the last, I don't know, 10, 20 odd years. So they know who has helped develop the game, I guess. And to be a name, to be talked about like that is absolutely unreal to me. It really is. And it was just a privilege to accept it, really. To think that I could have played a small part in helping grow this game in our country is just so, so special to me.
Yeah, it's wonderful. With great recognition comes great responsibility. Did you sort of look at your name up there and think there's more I need to do? Or is there a certain weight to that as well? Because your name is up with just three others at the moment.
Yeah, obviously look at Rachel Yankee. She's a legend within her own rights in the game. Emma Hayes is still going strong and winning trophies. And then obviously Farrah being the most capped England women's player or male player ever so far. So these are some very special names that I'm in and amongst. And I think I've still got a big role to play in doing my bit as much as I can in the punditry world and the radio world. And obviously, I'm a proud ambassador for Barclays. I like to go into schools and inspire those generations of girls to dream big, to take up the game if they're not as confident or don't have a lot of self-esteem, try and get them playing. I think that's certainly important to me to navigate towards those young kids, because I never had that opportunity growing up. I had to be thrown into a boys' team. Now, fortunate enough, I was quite good as a young kid, but some of these girls maybe have an interest in playing it, but don't have the confidence. So that's why we want to give equal access to football in schools by 2024. Just get as many young girls playing as we can.
You're also, of course, leading on from that when we talk about moving the game forward and your part within it, just been announced on the FIFA advisory group as well. So that's headed up by Jill Ellis, and you join Emma Hayes in that as well. Alex Morgan, England sports scientist Dawn Scott, German referee Bibiana Steinhaus-Webb as well in there. So there's another contribution there for you to make to the game. One of the most contentious talking points, and you can tell me to be off if you like, is this biennial World Cup, basically a World Cup every 2 years. Are we allowed a little insight from you on how you feel about this?
I don't actually have an insight. I'm being totally honest. I was on the first call and I had to drop off because my wife was called into a meeting, and then I couldn't make the second call. But I am actually going to the third meeting in London, I think it's next week. But I don't actually know the juice about it yet.
Mm. Are you in favour or not?
Oh, it's so difficult. it's such a difficult question, because traditionally the World Cup is every 4 years, and that's what a player, a footballer, looks out for and wants to be a part of. So to bring it to every 2 years, it kind of takes the specialness away from it. And you want to be seen as, if you are a World Cup champion, that you hold it for 4 years rather than 2 years. But I can understand, obviously, changing it from the men's side of the game and making it more appealing to the sponsors and to give other nations chances to progress their game And I don't know, it's so difficult. I'll let you know more when I'm in this third meeting and make my opinion then.
I've totally put you on the spot with that.
I know, it's difficult.
Thank you for answering. Well, speaking of World Cups, we'll talk about the next World Cup qualifiers next.
You're listening to the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, you can get a third off a subscription right now by heading to theathletic.com/WSL pod.
Okay, well, England take on Latvia away in their next World Cup qualifier on Tuesday evening. A win would keep England top of the group, but if they lose, it would be the first time since 2002 that England have lost a World Cup qualifier. Fran Kirby's looking to get her 50th cap for the Lionesses. And Ellen White, could surpass, Kelly, your record as England women's top goal scorer. Do you fancy her chances to do that? And will there be a little bit of, oh, God, no, for you?
I thought she would break it against Northern Ireland, being the form that she's in, but it wasn't meant to be. It didn't happen. Latvia are a less of a side than Northern Ireland. If Ellen White starts, I do believe that she will break it in this game because of the quality of players that England have and just how Latvia are as a defensive side. So if she gets those opportunities and she does it and she scores a hat-trick, then I will be the first to call on her and congratulate her. I think she has been outstanding over the last few seasons for club and country. And I remember playing with Ellen at Arsenal in England when she was on the left or right of a front three, and she was always up and down the wing. She was never really a central figure, but she's just changed her game so well. And she's now feared worldwide for her goal scoring ability, and you know, records are there to be broken, and it couldn't happen to a nicer person. She's so humble, she's so hard working, she's the ultimate professional. And if it does happen, I'll be so made up for her because she's such a nice person.
Well, elsewhere on Tuesday, Wales take on Estonia, Northern Ireland play Austria, and Scotland have a friendly against Sweden. Well, speaking of internationals, the draw for Euro 2022, which will be hosted in England, will also be taking place on Thursday. We'll catch up with that in the next episode of the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Let's move on to domestic action then. And at the weekend, Man City take on Chelsea and Arsenal take on Brighton in the FA Cup semi-finals. Emma, how do you fancy Brighton's chance against Arsenal? It's going to be such a tough game, isn't it, this one?
A really tough game. Arsenal was probably the team that you didn't want to face, given the form that they're in, and obviously Beth Mead coming out of the international break with at least a hat-trick at Wembley. That's before, obviously, the game against Latvia. So it's going to be a really difficult test for Brighton and for Hope Powell. But we know that Hope sets her teams up well organised. She will look to try and keep Arsenal at bay, but I think it's really difficult to see past Arsenal, and I actually think I think they'll be looking to go all the way in the FA Cup this season. So I think Man City, Chelsea, whoever wins that game, they got an even harder game in the final if Arsenal are in there.
Yeah, certainly. In terms of Man City injuries, many players still out. There was some good news before the Continental Cup win over Everton that Vicky Lasada for City is nearing a return, so she could be back for this one. And of course, City did register a win over Everton in the Conti Cup. Will the international break have done them some good, Kelly, at all? They've had such a, well, bad start to the season, really, haven't they, City?
You couldn't have asked for this starting the season with the amount of injuries that they've had. It's been a real difficult start. I don't know how many players that they will have back fit. You said Lasada. I don't know how many are close back, but they really need them back as soon as possible because they're missing such a vast amount of experience, especially with Steph and Lucy, big game players, big dressing room players. And it's going to be hard for them until they're back and in amongst it. I can't see them overturning Chelsea, if I'm honest, with the way Emma sets up, and they're full of confidence right now, Chelsea. So it's going to be a tough game for both, but I do see Chelsea coming out on top.
There we go. All right. Well, that's all we have time for on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. It's time for us to say our goodbyes now, but not before we tell you to head over to @OffsideRulePod on Twitter. And you can check out The Athletic as well, actually, for all the latest women's football news. Time to thank my guests as well. WSL Hall of Famer, all-time great, Kelly Smith. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Keep you posted on that FIFA advisory panel, yeah?
I sure will.
And also Emma Sanders as well. Emma, where does your football journey take you next?
Well, it's Latvia today and then back to the FA Cup semi-finals and more Premier League on the weekend.
Full of football. That's what we like to hear. Well, thanks to both of you for joining us. Listeners, we shall speak again soon.
The Athletic Women's Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Now. With a Now Sports membership, you can watch the biggest moments from the Women's Super League live. Find out more at nowtv.com.
The Athletic.